for this morning is Christian O'Neill, and you will hear first from the screen.
Thank you, Your Honor. A criminal defendant constitutionally protected the right to present evidence to defend himself against criminal charges is fundamental to our criminal justice system. Therefore, admissibility is the baseline. The ruling by the Indiana Supreme Court did not let the defendant here admit into evidence the video statement of a 9-year-old girl of Amanda Buck. If Amanda's video statement was taken as true, the defendant could not have committed the murders.
Did either the government or defense counsel at any point track down the bank deposit records or the school field trip records to determine whether the dates were consistent with the statements provided to the police?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
That they did or did not?
They did not. There's no indication in the record. No.
And I thought that was why there was also a theory of ineffective assistance of counsel, actually, because these seem to be low-hanging fruit.
I agree with you, Your Honor. I mean, as to that point.
Let me ask you this again in terms of the record. Is there any indication anywhere as to why Mandy was not called back on the stand after she reviewed the video?
The only thing that I can see in the record is that the trial counsel believed that they were entitled to bring in the statement under past recollection recorded. They probably, and that's one of the parts of the ineffectiveness, they should have at the minimum put her on the stand to lay the very simple foundation.
Why wasn't that put into the record in the post-conviction relief proceeding when the counsel for Mr. Cooch had an opportunity to develop the record about what further investigation might have shown or what was said in the deposition prior to the trial?
I have no way to answer that. It's not in the record.
Every opportunity to develop that record, correct?
I believe post-conviction counsel did have an opportunity. They didn't do so. But I think that the position that we have here, Your Honor, is that it should be clear. Normally, ineffectiveness is determined in post-conviction, but on this record, I think you can read that all trial counsel had to do to lay the simple foundation is simply say, is that you, Amanda?
And well, they know what the answer is because they took her deposition before, correct?
That's correct. So, I mean, but even without the deposition, and no respect, they simply had to lay the simple foundation of, is that you, and you had no basis to lie at that time.
So I think we need to, I mean, we can go back to ineffectiveness anytime somebody wants to, but on the first part of your case, the Chambers part, we need to consider, you know, when it is correct to override a state evidentiary rule. We certainly have to take the Supreme Court of Indiana at its word that the Indiana past recorded recollection rule had not been satisfied. That's what they say. We're not in the business of telling the Indiana court how to construe Indiana law. But if it wasn't satisfied, then can you suggest to me what you think the limiting principles are for Chambers?
I believe that it is a difficult standard to meet, but it's met here simply because the rule was applied ritualistically in a very rigid way.
8035.
I mean, and the reason is the statement was more reliable than the rule even required. And the second part is that the evidence was so material, it would establish that he couldn't have done the murders. At least not the murders on the scenario that the prosecutors contend.
So you get that from Chambers and the cases following Chambers
yes.
in the Supreme Court? Because obviously
yes.
We bear in mind Williams against Taylor that a state court decision is contrary to a Supreme Court decision if it arrives at a result different from that the court's decision would call for or unreasonably refuses to extend on the application branch. But the majority opinion in this case said, you know, does this mean all police reports or all police video interviews come in? Or is there some limiting factor?
No, not at all. There has to be some high degree of reliability.
But what is the going on here? There's extreme uncertainty as to the date of the video, right?
It was the date of the video was 4 days after the homicides were committed, Your Honor. The homicides occurred on September 18th.
Sorry, but there's extreme uncertainty as to whether she saw these people on the after the murder.
And reviewing the video, and she's pretty clear, I mean, and she's quite detailed as to what she saw. In fact, she gave the whole scenario of a whole weekend.
But of course, it was the day, right?
Right, but I mean, she had a
pretty good... Isn't the only evidence of that it was Thursday instead of Friday, this hearsay statement by the grandfather?
That's correct.
And it comes into evidence.
Right, and another statement that caused... And the other statement from Monica that came in years later saying gave a totally different scenario that's not even synced with just shifting the day. It was Aaron was there at the house from 3 to 9 o'clock. It's another parallel universe altogether.
Don't we know that Aaron gets picked up from school at a time during the period when he supposedly is also being murdered?
He picked up from school at approximately between, to be my reading of the record, 2:35 to 2:25 to 2:35. The cutoff period from the state scenario is 2:51. Driving 8 minutes there, apparently he was observed wearing shorts. He was not found wearing shorts. He was found wearing long pants. And even the state conceded that they only had like 5 minutes to create this scenario of three people being killed, cleaning up.
That actually tightened the time frame for the murder from, approximately 12:30 to 2:51 to 2:35 to 2:50.
Yes, yes. I mean, if you give it at the end of 2:25, and we had 8 minutes to get there, then you're down to very few minutes when all this could have occurred under the scenario. Yes?
How does your theory apply? Let's say we were dealing with a life sentence. Would you stick with the same rule?
I believe it should be, but I'm afraid the case law indicates a life sentence would be a similar rule. I think what's more
Chambers was a life sentence,
right? Yeah, and it would be the same.
About 30 years.
I don't think that in a criminal case,
any deprivation of liberty would be subject to the rule you're advocating, correct?
A substantial deprivation.
Because I mean, what the Chambers court says, this is a matter of due process. Due process is classically something that balances additional procedural protections against the interest of the state, the interest of the party, the accused party. And the Chambers Court keeps saying, to the criticism of later dissenting justices, that this is all circumstances. Truly, one circumstance is capital versus non-capital sentences.
It could be a factor, but in the sense that I think what's even more concerning is that it's a circumstantial evidence.
What does a trial judge do with that rule if only in serious cases we depart from the rules of evidence?
I think the key factor here is that you look to whether it's a circumstantial evidence. And I mean, obviously, as a practical matter, more serious cases are going to be looked at closely.
Isn't that a problem with all applications of Chambers? If you have to say that state evidentiary rules can't stand in the way of the defendant's ability to present his defense, then where are the state evidentiary rules? And yet the Supreme Court has not only Chambers, but it's got Green against Georgia, it's got Crane against Kentucky, it's got Rock, it's got, case after case in which they apply this rule.
But I think that they look to see how ritualistic and how rigid is the rule.
Well, when you say ritualistic, what are you looking for? Reliability of evidence, corroboration, existence of cumulative nature versus non-cumulative nature?
I think the two big points are is whether the evidence is reliable, particularly if it's more reliable than the rule requires, and whether the evidence is material. That's the way I read the Supreme Court case.
Are you advocating a relaxed hearsay rule for defendants?
No, I'm saying that sometimes...
The state also? The state would have this... You're advocating a loosening hearsay rule. That's showing the reliability that you think of. And I'm just asking you whether this is just for defendants?
Well, the
famous for defendants in capital cases, or do we let down the barriers to hearsay evidence by the prosecution?
Well, the defendants have the right to confront and present their defense.
I don't understand that. I don't see how you can just have defendants using hearsay and prosecutors not. I've never heard of such a suggestion.
Well, but I believe that you can read Chambers that way, and you can read the line of cases that way, Your Honor.
Well, but Chambers involves hearsay, but I thought there was some indication that there was an asymmetry in the other direction, that the state could have introduced this
and
not the defendant. And
right.
So now it's just equalized up to put the defendant on the same.
Surely you don't mean to suggest, Mr. Friedman, that if Amanda had lived across the street from the Cooch's and said she had seen Mr. Cooch there at 2:30 as Aaron and his father arrived, and then everything else was the same, I forget, I can't remember anything, you don't think the prosecution could put that tape in, do you, and convict him on that basis?
I believe one of the cases that were cited in the previous opinions, the Horton case and the Impressant case.
After Crawford, do you think?
Yes, because they said
could be convicted on the basis of a videotaped statement.
I mean, as long as there's a right of cross-examination.
She just has no recollection about. That's very, very troubling.
I believe under the case law, yes. I mean, they've done it.
If you were representing a petitioner who'd been convicted on that kind of evidence, you'd be outraged. And you'd be right.
Well, probably the most effective way to cross-examine that the issues I believe you have is with past recollection recording rule in the first place. I mean, once those rules are complied with, and the state has complied with them in the Horton case and the Impressant case, and they'll let that testimony in, I don't believe it has Crawford implications because there's still the right of cross-examination.
So there's something about video recording that puts it in a different category.
Well, part of it is yes, because they get a chance to observe the demeanor. That's number one. It's an important.
You know who the person is. I mean, assuming you put some evidence in on it.
Yes, and then that's
I
one of
it. I contested that this was Amanda in the video, as I recall.
What do we do then with the next case where we've got an audio recording, or we have, Chambers didn't involve any recording at all, did it?
That's correct.
So we have a witness who comes in with a great memory and detailed notes of what happened. That would need to come in too, wouldn't it?
They've let police reports in previously and laid the foundation for it. I mean, that's the issue concerning
under 8035.
That's correct.
So, but let's get back to Chambers. Chambers involves vouching and hearsay. And the court says, the Supreme Court says in Chambers, you let the hearsay statements involved in the case, that's these other three people, who say it was somebody else, were made under circumstances that provided considerable assurance of their reliability. They're made spontaneously, they're made shortly after the murder, they're corroborated by other evidence. The speaker stands to benefit nothing from them, and the speaker is present in the courtroom under oath. So is that some kind of template, or is there more going on that we need to satisfy?
No, I mean, Chambers is just one factual scenario. Here, our case is stronger than Chambers. What we have on this video is a police officer taking down...
So circumstances... giving some assurance of reliability. It is Amanda, and this is what she said. It's nobody saying, I think I remember her saying X.
That's correct. And you also have...
But there's no reason to think that we don't know what day, right?
Well, she believed that that's the day at the time.
She gives statements which, as we've established, were not followed up on, that would allow you to pin the day down very easily. The field trip is the next day. Her mother cashed a check that afternoon. Her mother's sitting there in the room and piping up every now and then in the video saying, yeah, that's right, I did this.
Yeah, but that's correct.
So there is, within the video, plenty of corroborating evidence.
That's correct.
Somebody had done anything to corroborate.
Right, and the mother is there at the minimum establishing that Amanda is not fantasizing. Amanda is giving the scenario and she's saying, yes, this is right. Yes, this is right. So it's, even if you put aside the corroboration of Monica, she's at least establishing that the Amanda is not just fibbing.
And the police officer repeatedly asks her, are you sure?
Yes, at least 3 or 4 times. And then asks Monica, are you sure? And she says yes.
And then she gives great specifics. I mean, she gives very detailed specifics, really, as to why she knows it's that Friday.
That's correct.
The jam part, because of the field trip going on the next day and the time they were supposed to leave early and all kinds of detail about that. As she does with much of what she says in that statement, when you look at the tape, she has a basis. I mean, she explains why she thinks a certain thing or why a certain thing happened. And that can certainly be taken into account.
That's correct. And I think another factor should be taken into account. You have a police officer taking down a statement, asking questions in a non-meaningful fashion. Just asking these questions. And Amanda and Monica don't know where he's going. So this is not staged. There's no evidence of it being staged. And they don't know what the significance of the answers of these questions are.
And there's no evidence whatsoever, I take it, of any incentive for Amanda or her mother to lie.
That's correct. And so they don't. And another factor that should be considered, Amanda says that Aaron was her best friend, so that she has no motive. I mean, she would have a motive to say just the opposite.
The question is not whether she's lying, but whether she's mistaken. And a reliability inquiry goes to the content of the statement, not whether it's an accurate recording of what she said.
Well,
that's my main point about the hearsay inquiry here, is that we test content reliability through cross-examination and corroboration. Those are the two key methods. And what we're concerned about is content reliability, not whether the recording accurately depicts what she said to the officer.
Well, that's what the jury is supposed to sort out.
Well, that would be all part of the fact that if this is an exception to the hearsay rule, then it comes in and you lose that extra thing that Judge Sykes is talking about. If it isn't, then you get it. But I'm going to remind you that there comes a point in the interview when they actually talk about what day this is. She said Saturday, the field trip, he was there. And the officer says, Monica, you said something back at your house when I was talking to you about, you said you cashed your check. Monica, yeah, Ryle, Friday. Monica, yeah, Ryle. And about what time after you came home from work? So it's actually the mother within the transcript.
That's correct.
Who gets it down to Friday. It's not Amanda.
That's correct, because she didn't have a watch with her. It was in her bag.
Let me ask you, in the majority opinion, there's a footnote that said, as far as we could tell, there was no jurisdiction where this tape would be admitted as substantive evidence. In your further research, have you found any?
Yeah, I believe the cases that I'm citing, the two Indiana cases, the Horton case and the Pissarro case, and I'm going to pronounce it, Empson case. That case was a battered woman who was reluctant to talk to the police. She didn't admit that he came back and hit her again, and she then finally signed an affidavit for his arrest, but then didn't want to testify. Said she didn't have any memory of the incident. And the court allowed it, the Indiana Appellate Court, I mean, not the Indiana Supreme Court, the Appellate Court admitted the statement in under 8035, said, well, she signed the affidavit, and it's also corroborated by what she told the officer.
I understand that, but I think the question is a little different, which is, even if all jurisdictions have some version of 8035, lots of them do, I'm sure some states don't, but overlaid on top of state hearsay rules is Chambers.
Gotcha.
So it's not that anybody is saying this fits within the four corners. I don't think we can. The Indiana Supreme Court has told us that we cannot. But overlaid on state evidentiary rules, including in Chambers and several of the subsequent cases, hearsay rules, Green against Georgia is also a hearsay rule case, we have this fundamental due process right to present a defense when there's no alternative, when there are circumstances indicating reliability, and when perhaps so much is on the table.
That's, I agree. I mean that's the whole point. Whether the, because the foundation itself, frankly, in my position and for our client, it doesn't mean very much.
What indicates reliability as to the date?
Excuse me.
Reliability as to the date of the post-transcript.
I mean, the reliability of the date is Amanda's statement itself, and if
and Lyle points here. I mean, earlier to what I was saying, Lyle says, "Now you remember last Friday, Mandy? Yes, they pick you up on Friday. They go on and on talking about Friday, and then the mother confirms that she cashes her check on Friday. So, I mean, further corroboration, I don't know, but it's certainly within the tape. There's a lot of discussion about Friday.
It's certainly enough that the jury should hear it, and then they could, the state could collaterally attack it, which they could if they wanted to. But
I think you make that argument about any hearsay. The jury should be allowed to make up.
I believe we have made that argument. I believe we have. I mean, maybe.
No, wait a second. Then you're saying there's no hearsay.
You're not saying that all hearsay is now admissible. You can't be
saying that.
Chambers doesn't say that either.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that the principles of Chambers yields over that rule as it's applied in this case.
In this narrow set of cases, Chambers doesn't apply most of the time. States are allowed to have hearsay rules.
Very few cases.
Yeah. But Chambers was based on the premise that there was both internal and external corroboration for the other suspect's confession. You know, the real killer. McDonald was the real killer, and he confessed under oath to Chambers' counsel, and that was one statement that he's wanted in. And then he confessed three times to three different people. And so his statement was not only internally corroborated by its detail, but it was externally corroborated by the other confessions, and it was also externally corroborated by eyewitness testimony that saw him with a gun. And so there was not just the internal corroboration that's being pointed out here in your case, but external corroboration as well. And to top it all off, there was an opportunity to cross-examine McDonald because he could be called as a witness and cross-examined and put his repudiation of his confession through the cross-examination ringer, as we do in trials. And that is not the case here. You're arguing for an extension of Chambers, not an application of Chambers.
Well, I'm not asking for an extension of Chambers.
Yes, you are. You are undoubtedly asking for an extension of Chambers for the reasons I just pointed out.
Let me ask it this way. We're under the deferential standard under the under 2254 D1, and we've got in the Montana against Aguiloff case, we've got four justices of the U.S. Supreme Court describing Chambers as an exercise in highly case-specific error correction, as opposed to some broader principles. Now, one can argue with whether that characterization is correct. But would a state court be unreasonable in treating Chambers that way?
Well, I believe they are unreasonable here, and they're unreasonable.
By treating it as a highly case-specific error correction that doesn't provide a whole lot of broad guidance.
Well, I believe that the cases do provide some guidance is when the rule doesn't serve justice, and whether it's arbitrary and disproportionate to the rule it serves, and that the evidence is material, and they meet that standard. I mean,
I understand you think Chambers should reach this case. And as you know, you and I disagreed about that on de novo review. But here we are really talking about the deferential review under the statute. And given the Supreme Court's characterization, or at least a plurality's characterization of the decision that way, how would it be unreasonable for a state court to approach it the same way?
That would be unreasonable.
Not wrong, but unreasonable.
It would be unreasonable because their rule that they're relying upon is so rigid. In the application in this particular case, because the evidence of reliability is greater than the rule that the rule requires it. It's very simple to get in some of these statements, and probably this is where I disagree about the role of Crawford.
Well, why isn't your answer really just that the Supreme Court itself, after the Montana case, in several other cases, has not so characterized Chambers, whether it's Holmes against South Carolina, whether it's Sears against Upton? The Supreme Court itself has told us it's something that's not just an opinion or a plurality.
And I agree. I think the general principle is whether the rule is so rigid it's inappropriately applied in this particular case, because it's applied arbitrary and disproportionate in this particular case, and the evidence is material. And we know that it's material because it exonerates.
Well, it's the only time. Well,
can fair-minded people disagree about that?
I don't think so on the factual pattern of this case.
What I don't understand, can it have probative value if the date can't be pinned down?
Can it be? It wasn't pinned down. I have to be honest. I mean, I just came in on this case on appeal. It wasn't pinned down. The state could have pinned it down, too. I mean, but it wasn't.
It just seems to be have really minimal probative value. So when it was.
I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. The date was Friday. You're saying it wasn't corroborated when you said it wasn't turned down, and it was the defense counsel didn't go ahead and try to get the other facts that would have supported what she said in the state.
That's right.
So it's internally inconsistent within the tape, and it's spoken of by two different people in the tape, if not three, but Monica and Mandy. It's just that what you're missing is some external bank deposit slipper or any of a number of other things. And so perhaps that takes us back to ineffective.
But that's not required under 8035 either, though. And the dispute was they just simply didn't lay the foundation. Unless there's anything else, I'll reserve it.
So it's just the old rule that if it's in doubt, let it in, it's auto wire.
Well, no. I believe you have to. You have to look at the whole circumstances of the case. You have to look.
Well, that's what I said. It's in doubt. Considering everything, let it in.
If the evidence is so material, yes, and the rule that had been violated later.
That's an old Indiana trial judge theory. It's in doubt, let it in.
The rule that didn't allow it in is simply it's me, and I would have lied at the time. And so in this case, in light of the credibility of this videotape, I would let it in. That's the argument that violates Chambers and his project.
All right, thank you, Mr. Friedman. Mr. Hovey.
May it please the court. This court should affirm the denial of habeas relief because the Indiana Supreme Court reasonably applied Chambers v. Mississippi. I'd like to talk a little bit about the statement itself because that is really the bottom line of this case. And as the district court described that statement, he said, the statement of a 9-year-old child no longer supported by her or any other witness is not readily described as competent and reliable. And that's what we have here.
Don't we need to look at what she said, though? I mean, it's the video is clear that she remembers a lot. I mean, the transcript shows that. We've let in statements from children much younger than that. In Harris against Thompson, it was a much younger witness. Why isn't it critical that this is evidence that would show actual innocence of the crime?
only if it is reliable evidence and evidence that is believed by the trial court.
Well, of course,
I mean, by the jury.
Yeah, I mean, the jury would have to believe it. The jury could reject it, of course. We don't know what the jury would do with it. But I don't see why, within itself, the police officer doesn't say that there's been any tampering with the tape. It's a police interview. It's in some formal circumstances. The mother is there. Participating as well, so if you worry about the child's age, you've got that. You've got lots of references to the fact that these are Friday events, and the grandfather doesn't call until 3 or 4 days later and say, oh, actually, you know, and this is all just the most indirect evidence. I just don't see what's unreliable about it.
If you look at the statement, Mandy herself never describes it as happening on Friday. That's prompted by the detective, and also it's Monica who actually provides that it's Friday. Amanda never does. And if you look at her description, she describes many things as you would expect a 9-year-old to describe things. It's not linear.
She describes them better than her mother does in some instances. What kind of truck?
Well, I would disagree with that. In fact, Mandy's asked what time she saw them, and she looks to her mother, and her mother's the one that answers the time question.
Well, look, Mandy says that's because I don't have my watch, because I had gym that day, and so my watch was in my backpack.
I believe she said she hadn't had her watch for a while, because, and then she gives this story about the gym bag. It wasn't that day. If you look at Mandy's statement,
why would she be answering the officer's questions? Now, do you remember last Friday? Yeah. And you told me earlier that you go to the Alphabet Academy. Uh-huh. They pick you up. Did they pick you up Friday? I don't see why that's Mandy not talking about Friday. Does she have to repeat every time, yes, I remember last Friday?
My point is that it's the detective that says, we're here to talk about last Friday, you remember last Friday. It's in a leading manner. And then it's Monica who provides the reassurance to Mandy, for example, when she says, when the officer asks her birthday, she gives her birthday, and then she looks to her mother, is that correct? Now, this is a 9-year-old who's relying on her mother for a lot of the facts.
A little bit, but then here Mandy says, again, you're talking about Friday, playing with him, he has some clothes lying on the porch, a bunch of clothes, you know, I thought he was going to spend the night there Saturday and Sunday, come home Monday. Saturday, the field trip, he wasn't there. She's giving a lot of context that it's Friday.
Well, nothing that ties it.
I don't know if the grandfather knows anything, whoever he is.
Not that ties it to Friday as opposed to Thursday. Everybody agrees that the field trip happened on Saturday, and
but
Mandy, in fact,
the next day.
No, she doesn't. She says that the plan was for Aaron. The plan was for Aaron to go to his mom's on Friday, and then the next day he was going to go to the field trip from his mom's house. That doesn't place that conversation happened on Friday. And in fact, it fits with Monica's version afterwards, which she says that Aaron told Amanda on Thursday that he was going to his mom's house right after school.
But Monica, during the interview, says that it was Friday, that it was the day she cashed her paycheck, that's the day she got paid.
Correct, and Monica comes back and says, I was wrong about that.
Right,
so I'd like to go back to my very first question to Mr. Friedman, because because the date of a bank deposit could have provided a basis to challenge the reliability of the statement, as could the date of the field trip. And the date of the bank deposit would have shed light on as to which of Monica's statements was accurate, that she was consistent in stating that the date she saw Aaron was the date of the deposit, but she was inconsistent as to whether it was Thursday or Friday. And we don't have those two things, it would seem.
In regard to the field trip, everybody agrees it happens on Saturday, and I don't think that pins it, as I've spoken, pins it on Thursday or Friday. As to the bank statement, Monica reviewed her recollection twice. Once a few days after the statement, and then next in March of 2000 when another officer went out and took her statement. And in both those times, Monica said, I've gone back and I've looked at what happened those days, and we were wrong. It was Thursday, not Friday.
So is your rule that any time a witness recants, that evidence is not admissible?
No, but a statement...
That's what you're arguing. This shouldn't come in because there was some potential recantation. So I guess all recanting witnesses are inherently so unreliable we don't let them talk.
A statement that's been recanted by a witness is less reliable than a statement that is endorsed by a witness.
You need this to be inadmissible.
No. In fact, the state doesn't.
It's inadmissible under state law.
But it's not inadmissible under Chambers if Chambers applies.
And that brings it back to the status of this case as being a review of the Indiana State Court decision. The state court decided that under 8035 it wasn't admissible, but it was admissible under 613B. So this isn't a case in which the state court excluded the evidence and said Chambers doesn't let it in. The state court said the evidence comes in. And so what then the state court did was say, okay, if the state, this was error, it should have come in now for impeachment.
Only to impeach a trivial point, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's
impeachment doesn't get very far at all here. So.
Except for
in the Chambers issue at all.
In this case, it would have only been impeachment because had this gone like the defendant suggests, Mandy would have testified like she did. I don't remember making the statement, and I don't remember seeing them. Monica would have taken the stand and said, I didn't see them on Friday. I saw them on Thursday. And then the defendant would admit the tape to impeach both of them. So in practice, this was impeachment evidence. And there's never been a suggestion by the defendant that Chambers would operate when a state allows evidence to come in, that Chambers would prevent the state from then the trial court from giving an instruction to the jury about how to treat that evidence. And that would be an extension of Chambers because
it comes in for impeachment purposes only. It just comes in to attack the credibility of the witness. It doesn't come in as substantive testimony about the time frame. You agree with that?
Correct. And
that's a big distinction here.
Correct. And in Chambers, we're dealing with impeachment evidence. So Chambers was saying, let this evidence in for impeachment.
Chambers,
No.
Chambers was being offered as substantive evidence to show that somebody else shot the police officer in Chambers.
Yeah.
Well,
It was hearsay, but it was admissible because of all the corroboration and the both external and the availability of cross-examination. But I think I don't see that the impeachment use of this gets anywhere at all because neither Amanda nor her mother at the time of trial were in a position to offer any evidence helpful to the prosecution. There was nothing to really impeach. That's what the Supreme Court told us when it said this was harmless.
If Monica would have testified, it would have helped the state because Monica said she didn't see them on that Friday. So the defendant's claim.
That's so true. That's no different from Amanda saying, I don't remember seeing him that day. That's not going to get anywhere.
Correct. And that's why the exclusion of the statement in the context of all the evidence was harmless, as the Indiana State Supreme Court decided.
It's harmless except he's going to be executed for it. I can't believe you're making a harmless error argument.
The defendant has to show that the excluded evidence had been admitted would have had a probable effect on the outcome, and that's under de novo review.
So if the jury had heard a story that he wasn't, that Mr. Cooch wasn't there during the time that the state is identified for the murders, I don't know whether the jury would have credited that or not, but if it had credited it, it would not have found Mr. Cooch guilty.
In order for the jury to do that, the jury would have had to.
This is a purely circumstantial case, as all courts to look at it have said. No, not a shred of specific evidence tying it to Mr. Cooch. And the district court, or the trial court, actually it was the district court, would have called it a slow-moving, avalanche or whatever of circumstantial evidence.
For the jury to believe Amanda that she saw Rick and Aaron at 3:30 on that day, they would have to believe she is the only one who is telling the truth and that the other evidence is not the truth. Because
it's the inferences from the other evidence, and we already know that Aaron picked up from school at 2:20 in the afternoon, consistent with Amanda's story.
Which, according to the defendant's own statement, was Rick was picking him up from school and bringing him over to Cooch's house. That was Cooch's story about what was going to happen that day. And in fact, that's
5 minutes for this murder to have taken place, not really within the time frame the state has identified.
That is giving the timeline the best to the defendant. He's suggesting that it took 15 minutes.
It was out early that day, right?
No, he's suggesting it took Aaron 15 minutes to go from the front of the school to Rick's truck. And the testimony is that he was parked out in front, so take 5 minutes to walk across, that's 2:25, and it takes 8 minutes to drive to the Koosh house. We're into 2:35 to 2:53 is when Koosh makes the call from his house. That's a large window that even Koosh says he was at home. Also, this is consistent with Aaron Hoddle's testimony, who lives across the street, which says that Rick's truck was across the street at that time. Not at his house, it was at the Koosh house. So what would have to happen is that the jury would have to believe this 9-year-old's statement.
And you think that's just impossible as a matter of law? The jury shouldn't be entitled to believe one witness over another?
It's not impossible, but it doesn't mean the defendant's...
So it does mean it's pretty important to be the only evidence, but it is evidence that would show actual innocence.
It doesn't meet the standard that the defendant has to meet, which under de novo review is a probable effect on the jury, or under Brecht, which is the proper standard, that it did have a substantial and injurious effect on the jury. It caused actual prejudice.
Mr. Foley, I think I share Chief Judge's view that I'm astonished to hear you arguing that if this was error to exclude this as substantive evidence, it would have been harmless. I don't see how you can say that. You can argue that it was not an error, not an unreasonable application of Chambers. And I frankly agree with you, as I wrote in the majority opinion in the panel. But I can't believe you would say this would be harmless error if it was an error.
That is what the state is saying, because in the context of that statement, you would have to have the jury ignore Monica saying we were wrong, ignore Lonnie saying we were wrong, and ignore that Amanda is not even saying I was right.
The jury didn't hear those points.
Correct.
And the state does have the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And this is direct evidence. It's inadmissible in my view, but it's flatly inconsistent with the state's theory. I really don't see how you can argue it's harmless.
The harmlessness is, was it excluded? And so it was excluded. So we look to see if it weren't excluded, what would have the trial looked like?
Why don't you spend your time talking about 2254D?
See, what you should have been saying is that the prosecutor would have made mincemeat of this evidence. Let me ask you, were there any other suspects in the murder?
Not, early on in the investigation, perhaps.
Mr. Hardy, I'm trying to remember. Hardy?
Yeah, Brad Hardy was an accomplice. He was charged as an accomplice with Koosh at the time of Koosh's first trial, but there's no suggestion ever that Brad Hardy acted alone. It was only in concert with the defendant, Wayne Koosh. There's no evidence that there was another suspect that was...
Did he cooperate eventually? He did cooperate eventually. So you say there's no evidence, but we have this other person who seems to have had something to do with this, and then he just sort of vanishes into the vapor.
Unlike Koosh, who constantly gave contradictory stories, Brad Hardy's story was always consistent, in fact, corroborated with other evidence, including his mom, who said she took him to Koosh's place of employment, that Koosh battery was dead, he had to get it jumped. All of that has been consistent for Hardy, unlike Koosh, who has changed his story anytime there's been evidence to rebut. I mean, Koosh the whole time spent his time in his statements trying to say that he was never at his house during that day. He left for work and then never came home. And every time they put him at the home, then he changed his story to say, oh yeah, I went home then. But nothing happened there. But that was the only time. And then they confronted him with something else, and he changed his story again. So, as the majority panel opinion here says, the strongest evidence against Koosh here was Koosh's testimony himself, because he was just not believable about saying he was not there when in fact he was.
I don't think anybody has ever said that if this video never existed, was there sufficient evidence to convict Mr. Koosh. I thought I made that quite clear at the beginning of my dissent. Sure. It's just, did the jury hear everything that it should have heard?
And that's what, again, that's what the Indiana Supreme Court decided. They decided that Chambers
one,
didn't...
One footnote, I mean, like a sentence on Chambers. So I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. I understand what the rules are. But they don't really think too hard about Chambers.
I think because they've already decided that an evidence rule lets this in. Chambers really only operates when,
so what
when
the
rules of evidence keep it out.
Disregards... No, they didn't decide that an evidence... No, now you're back to your impeachment theory, and that doesn't work. They thought that the evidence was properly excluded for the truth, although because of the scope of 8035. So they say that much is the rule in Indiana. What they don't do is then go do a careful analysis of what the line of cases, beginning with Chambers, requires and ask themselves, but is there some exception to our state evidentiary rule of exclusion that we ought to apply here?
I think they don't do that is because Chambers and the line of cases afterwards speak of excluding evidence. The evidence was excluded. The rule excludes this type of evidence, and so it was excluded.
Are you equating still impeachment with truth?
No, but what I'm suggesting is that there's no clearly established rule in Chambers that says the state has to admit certain evidence for the truth, because Chambers really didn't do that. What Chambers did was McDonald's confession came in, and he testified. The defendant was prevented from cross-examining McDonald because of this voucher rule.
That's
that was impeachment.
Part. They're not talking about that. The trial court refused to allow him to introduce the testimony of Harden, Turner, and Carter. Those relevant only for the truth. That's the only thing that would have come in.
No, I disagree.
The reason it didn't come in is because the state, in that instance, Mississippi, did not allow for statements that were against penal interest, statements only against pecuniary interest.
McDonald's story was that his first confession was coerced, and that's the only reason he confessed. And so the defendant wanted to bring in these other confessions to show, look, he confessed when he wasn't coerced, so believe his confession. That's impeachment evidence. Don't believe what he's telling you on the stand now. Believe something he said at a different time.
No, I think that it was coming in for more than that. He gave a sworn statement. We have all of these other people that McDonald confesses to.
I think putting this in a hypothetical.
To show the jury that McDonald had repeatedly confessed to the crime, so he wants, and that's why it's hearsay.
I think if a hypothetical would help, if this case had been that the state trial court admitted the evidence under 613B, admitted her statement, and gave a limiting instruction, the defendant's Chambers claim would have to be that giving that limiting instruction violates my right to present a defense.
I don't know. You can make this argument. I'm completely unpersuaded by the line that you're drawing, because if it's not in for the truth, it might as well not be in. If we're going to go along with the fiction that juries observe limiting instructions, the jury has now walled us off in its mind from any use for the truth.
But the question is, can the Indiana Supreme Court read Chambers that way? Is that a reasonable...
The only thing Chambers says...
Is that a reasonable... The way the Supreme Court...
The only reading of Chambers.
That's what the defendant would have to show to win. But
not
the state...
That's correct.
That Chambers can be read to not require this distinction. That if the rule lets it in, there's not a Chambers violation. And then the further point is that the defendant has to show that the harmless error analysis or the materiality analysis of the Chambers claim is not met.
Mr. Kobe, I would have thought your best argument is simply that the Chambers analysis is fairly specific to that case and that the balancing test that it adopts is open textured enough that state courts have reasonable latitude to disagree on its application to these facts. This business about impeachment and harmless error is going nowhere. Mm-hmm. And I believe is entirely new. I don't remember any of this from the panel briefing or discussion, but
I think that there's a distinction there that I think that perhaps I haven't drawn clearly enough. On the one hand, there's a harmless error question. And then on the other hand, there's a question of what Chambers requires, clearly requires. And here, what the state is arguing is that the state Supreme Court could read...
You weaken your argument when talking about harmless error, right? You acknowledge error and then you talk about being harmless. Your point is that this evidence did not have enough probative weight to overcome the hearsay rule. Right? That's your argument.
Yes, it was not reliable or corroborated. And that's what makes it weak, if it were admitted. Because nothing corroborates that it happened, that Amanda's right, that it happened on Thursday instead of Friday. To this day.
Friday instead of Thursday.
Correct. Notwithstanding all the opportunity from the defendant and all the investigation by defense counsel to the contrary. If there are no further questions, the state asks that you affirm the denial of habeas relief. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kobe. Anything further, Mr. Friedman?
Just briefly.
Are you familiar with the academic literature that finds that jurors are skeptical of your studies?
I'm skeptical of the...
Skeptical of your studies. That if your say evidence is admitted, jurors tend not to be
afraid. But they should be allowed to consider it if it violates Chambers. And here, all trial counsel had to do was lay this foundation, which is circular. That's me.
But Eric, you acknowledge to you that if you can use hearsay evidence freely, so can
we. They have done so under 8035, and if he had complied. Trial counsel had complied with the 803 requirement, the very simple foundation, that's me, and that was video, and I have no basis to lie, then all this would have been sorted out in front of the jury. Then we would have found out whether they would have made mincemeat about it. I'm not so sure. They're pretty inconsistent.
You drown the jury in hearsay.
But this is a... But this is a pretty critical piece of evidence that exonerates somebody, and it's a video.
Well, it seems very weak, actually.
I looked at the video and I thought it was very compelling, and I guess, but should appellate court make these decisions when, if the lawyer had just laid the simple foundation, we would have found out where they would have met me.
You keep wanting to blame the lawyer, and I keep wanting to say, where's the record as to what would have happened if the lawyer had done it? I would have thought that was elementary in putting together a claim for ineffective assistance of counsel. Here's what the lawyer didn't do. Here's what would have happened if they had done it. These were highly capable, experienced teams of lawyers at every stage of this case.
Well, all I can say is what we have now in front of this record, on the record that's before this court, is that the prosecutors will have to get up and say, it didn't happen that way. Not subject to any cross-examination, didn't happen that way. And this was a pretty circumstantial evidence case. They had no trouble putting on Tasha Penn and David Nichols, who changed her testimony all over the place. And we, the defense never had their defense, never had their day in court. And the video would have presented their day in court, and I believe it was a compelling video. If there's anything else, I guess.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Friedman. Thanks as well, Mr. Kobe and your counsel. The court will take under advisement.